time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
When too much networking would be barely enough.
Rooters, witches, firewalls,
a podcast on the data networking industry. Rooting, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Whatever it is, we'll talk about it. Are you ready?
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology, and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and various ideas, and we get together to talk about them. Get comfortable, and we're going to gather around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world, humor, wit, and maybe even some technical talent around the table for today. And speaking of talent, today we are going to cover Enterprise IPv6 and brought in some heavy hitters. One of those is Jan Bever. Jan, introduce yourself and tell the folks where you're from and what you do.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jan Bever. I work as a chief engineer in the solution engineering group of NIL in Slovenia. I focus mostly on security, network applications, and IPv6 and virtualization. I work for NIL for the last 15 years, and I passed my CCA in 97, and that's about it.
Great. And we also have Matt Ryanzak with Aaron. Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do with Aaron.
Hi, I'm Matt Ryanzak. I am the network operations manager at Aaron. I've been here for a little over 8 years now, and we've been running IPv6 for about that long almost. You can find out more about Aaron at www.aaron.net, and we have a blog also at teamaaron.net that gets especially into detail about V4 depletion and IPv6 adoption, things cool. Like that.
That sounds great. And Mr. Farrow is with us also, feeling a little bit under the weather, but he was able to join the call anyway. Greg, how you doing?
I'm functioning. I'm back from Tech Field Day last week, and I picked up the flu that you dragged into the event with you. Seeing as we had like about 16 of us jammed into little tiny rooms, it was really only a matter of time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid it was. I think Stretch got sick also, and Plankers got sick, and not good.
That's the way of it, but it was a good event, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tech Field Day was great, and I can't believe the amount of material that we've already generated coming out of that between blog posts and podcasts already and so on. Really, really a lot of good content, and I think everybody had a great time of learning and getting to know each other and so on. It was good stuff.
Was there anybody there who didn't look like what you expected? You know how when you meet people that you've been seen on the internet, and then you get together, and then all of a sudden somebody doesn't look like the way you expected?
Stretch was younger than I expected, just because you read his posts and all the stuff that he's done, and even looking at his avatar, he looks older. Then I'm like, oh man, he's just a baby.
I met Stretch a couple of years back, but it was Josh Horton who surprised me, because he was not what I was expecting.
That's
cool. And also Terry Slattery, of course.
Well, Terry, I had never seen a shot of him. I mean, I knew he'd been around the industry for a while because certainly his reputation precedes him. But I had really no expectation of what Terry looked like, and it was great to meet him for sure. Very very talkative guy, no ego there at all. Just eager to share and chat and network and all that stuff. It was good.
It was great. We should get on.
We should. So this show today is about Enterprise IPv6. If you are going to deploy IPv6 in your enterprise, what are the things that you need to do? There's a lot of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt about IPv6 and how to get it going in your company. And I think, in my mind, that's probably one of the biggest barriers of why it hasn't been adopted. Everyone talks about it, and IPv4 depletion on the public internet certainly gets a lot of press, but there's still very little traction in companies making a motion to get to IPv6, to really get serious about deploying IPv6. So what I wanted to do is get a show together where we get some guys who have expertise in this area and talk through it. What are the things to consider when deploying IPv6 in the enterprise? What are the considerations? What are the challenges? What are the things to be aware of? What are the things that are legitimately to be feared versus what are the things that are just overblown hype and, hey, you can get through this and it's really not that big a deal? So that's really the setting and what I was hoping to talk about, and that's why I'm really glad Matt and Jan could come in and share their expertise. So let's start what I kind of think of as the beginning here, which is which is IPv6 addressing. We're used to dotted quad. We're used to IPv4, and we've all been using it for a very long time and are really comfortable with it. Most of us know how to do subnet masking and so on. Then you look at an IPv6 address, and you're going, what am I looking at? There's colons and odd things going on there, and it makes me nervous. Matt, you want to take that one? Just kind of talk through the basics of the IPv6 addressing structure?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, everybody's used to IPv4 addresses. You have your dotted quad notation, and it's, I think, gotten very easy for everybody to recognize and to read, both, you know, by humans and programmatically using regex or whatever. V6 is, well, completely different. You know, I was at a conference a while back, and one of the presenters was describing V6 as completely ugly, horrible to look at. And I think there is a lot of truth to that. It is hard for our eyes to get around all of those colons and all of those letters and numbers. So it's just drastically different.
And by colons and numbers, I mean we've really got hexadecimal component to the addressing now. That's really what the letters are all about.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Yeah, it's based on hexadecimal. It's rather being delimited by periods, it's delimited by colons now, and that makes it very difficult. For instance, if you're we're very used to going to IP address colon port number for certain applications, whether it be a web server running on a different port or any application. How do you do that in V6 when you have colons inherent in the address itself? There are ways to do that. It's actually defined in RFCs. For what it's worth, you typically use brackets to enclose the address and then put a colon port number after that. But even, you know, looking at that is very difficult. And when you get into doing regex matches for this kind of stuff, it's difficult. It's further complicated by the fact that when IPv6 has a certain shorthand to it as well. So if you have periods of zeros in an address, you can shorthand those by just canceling all the zeros out and placing double colons there. And that can happen anywhere in the address, but only once. So it's just a lot more complicated, and it's something that people should certainly be aware of and read the documentation for.
Now, Matt, you're scaring the listeners. You keep saying difficult. realistically, though, the more you work with it, it's like anything. The more you work with it, the easier it gets.
You know, I think that there was a time when people looked at IP addresses and said, oh, geez, this is difficult. I don't understand that. And, you know, then things got changed up on them when they went to CIDR. Address notation got a lot more complex. It used to be A network, B network, C network, and we went into basically the network could be anything, and you just used a / 20 or a / 21. This is really no different than that. It's just a learning curve. I think everybody needs to get used to that. So, you know, I certainly don't mean to preach gloom and doom. It's not that hard. It's just different. Mm. And, you know,
I've been able to get – I'm finding that the more I read it and work in it and tool around with it, it gets easier. You just adapt. I mean, a lot of it's just familiar. We're familiar with the 4-octet, you know, IPv4 address, and it's just up – you start developing ways of handling it. For example, I have a piece of software on my Mac which allow text expander, and pre-programmed in there I have a thing which is bang IP6, and when I press it automatically puts a global prefix down, so I don't have to remember my global prefix. It just keeps banging it down, and I think terminal programs and, you know, we'll have bash scripts, everybody will have a way of solving that challenge going forward, because mostly all you need to know is the global prefix, isn't it?
That's correct. In fact, the host part of the address, it's almost forgettable at this point because of things like auto configuration and mobility that could change, you know, at any time in some circumstances. So you really don't need to know that anymore. It really is just the network portion of the address that's important.
Let me tell you a little aside. I made a joke on my blog a couple of weeks back about the name of how we have the octets in an IP. There's 4 octets. But what's the name of the piece in an IPv6 address? Is it a chunk, or is it a bit? Is it a section? So I made a joke and called it a chazwaza, and put a blog post up on my blog saying the name of that is a chazwaza. And somebody's recently got in contact with me, a guy by the name of L. Donahacky, and he's actually raised an RFC to give it a name. And there's an RFC submitted that references my blog as the inspiration.
So he submitted Chazwaza officially?
He said Chazwaza was a joke, but it pointed out the fact that it was
Gotcha. Okay.
We need to have a name for it, you know.
Yeah.
Perhaps just Chaz. That's a little shorter.
Mm.
Chaz, yeah. I suggested it. So there's 16 Chazes to an IPv6 address.
Yeah.
Hey, Jan, what kind of success have you had when you're rolling out a brand new IPv6 addressing scheme to a company? I mean, are there tricks you've kind of figured out how to use, to get everybody comfortable with the idea and what they're looking at?
Yeah, well, one thing which a lot of people forget is that typically you, well, today it's actually mandatory to leave the last 64 bits for the host. So it's, you're not as free as in the IPv4 world to choose basically the division between the network and the host part. So also looking at addresses from this perspective, if you have to use the last 64 bits for the host part, and for the servers at least, you can do a very simple trick and use, let's say, only the last 8 bits or 16 bits for the server, and IPv6 addresses become much simpler because you zero out a large part of the host address, especially for the statically addressed hosts. The second thing which is interesting is that if we agree, or the current standard being that you have to use the last 64 bits as the host address, you are left with the first 64 bits, of which typically 48 are allocated to you, or perhaps less, which gives you about 16 bits to play with for the network part, or for the subnet part, let's say. And what I found is that having hexadecimal characters in there, from A, B, C, and D, and E, and F, you can do a lot of nice tricks, like use D for the DMZ network, use E for the experimental. I have a customer who actually has certain departments which are named from E to F, and this like perfectly goes with their departmental scheme. So in this regard, I think you have much more freedom and a little bit more intuition, perhaps, even if you have a hexadecimal notation. Although, again, you'd probably need a couple of months of work for this to really become intuitive to you. But again, remembering an IPv6 address is not that difficult. Again, you have to remember the first 48 bits, which is your network typically. Then you have 16 bits, which typically have a meaning for you, like a VLAN number or location or a department. And then the last 64 bits are typically, again, simple, at least for the servers.
And you both have alluded to something here, that part of the point of this exercise with IPv6 is, hey, we're never going to run out of IPv6 addresses again. And I don't have the number in front of me. Maybe one of you other guys do, but it's some really, really, really large number of unique IPv6 addresses that are available to the world. So that brings me to another point here, because in IPv4, one of the tricks that we've used to extend the life of IPv4 is NATing, where we'll take the RFC 1918 address space, that the 10 dot and the 172.16.31.192.168, and we'll use those on our private enterprise networks and then NAT them out to something publicly. Does that kind of a technique still play in with IPv6? Is there a private address space and then something that you're going to NAT or not? What do you do when you get your block?
NAT is like a four-letter word in IPv6, I think. So what you will typically do is you will get your block either from a provider address space or a provider-independent block as well, which is now available through RIPE for a couple of months. And you have various techniques to NAT from the IPv6 to the IPv4 world, and they are all horrible. And I don't know of any implementation for IPv6 to IPv6 NATing, which would actually work, but I don't think you should actually use it. So even though I'm a fan of NAT in the IPv4 world, I would definitely recommend against any kind of NAT in the IPv6 world, either for translation to IPv4 or native 6 to 6 NAT, which, again, I'm not aware of any existing product. So I would say absolutely forget about NAT in the IPv6 world. Sometimes the provider might do some NATing for you, for example, to expose some parts of the internet, but those are, I think, solutions which are not really mature, and this is a problem which service providers currently face, how to interconnect V4 and V6 networks for people who are not dual stack. So in short, for enterprises, I would say in the long run, or in the short run, forget about any kind of NAT.
Matt, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think that what Jan has said is completely true. IPv6 was not designed with NAT in mind. I think, however, NAT is a result of V4 transition requirements. The requirement for V6 networks to connect to V4 networks and vice versa. There's been some NAT developed for that. Cisco had NAT-PT, which was actually deprecated, and they're working on new technology now. The IETF, I know, is working on NAT-66 techniques and NAT-64 as well to help with transition. And I think that something else that's important to point out is, at least here in the United States, we have the PCI, which is the payment card industry, and they define some network security guidelines if you're accepting credit cards and doing other transactions online. And they actually require NAT for hosts that are doing payment processing. And right now, V6 doesn't really offer those kind of capabilities. You won't find a firewall or a NAT box that that can provide that for you on V6, which is potentially a problem.
It'll be interesting if the payment card services that work together on the PCI standards look at IPv6 and go, you know, technically this wasn't, you know, intended for, I mean, that's really just an obfuscation of an address. It's not, I mean, you can call it a security technique, but it's one small part of a much larger security security design. So,
you know, I think V4.NET was originally envisioned to extend V4 addresses. You know, there was a time in the early 90s where everybody said, geez, we need to come up with ways to conserve addresses. And, you know, that's when CIDR was developed for getting away from classful addressing. But it evolved into this security mechanism that people use because it does obfuscate these networks. You can no longer see what hosts are on the inside of the network. And it's difficult to do that with V6 right now. It's not impossible. There's actually some RFCs out there, and I can't remember the names off the top of my head, that talk about how to obfuscate your network when all of your addresses are global. One other thing I think worth pointing out is there is a form of kind of RFC 1918 addresses in IPv6. It's not really intended for the same use, but they have something called unique local addresses, or EULA. And this is a /7 worth of V6 space that was set aside in order for networks to address themselves that are not connected to the internet. So if you have, you know, a factory or something like that where you have all these IP-enabled devices, you could use EULA to address all those devices. And the RFCs that govern how EULA is to be used, they define an algorithm that you can use to define basically what your network number will be and pretty much, I mean, almost completely guarantee that it will be unique to the site that you're deploying it on. And that could be used for RFC 1918 type addressing. And eventually, I really think that we'll probably see some form of V6 NAT. So you take those two together, and you'll have the same kind of functionality that you have in V4 today. It's just not quite there yet, but I suspect that you'll see it eventually.
Well, it sounds like from what you're both saying is the intention of this long-term is you're going to get your block of globally addressable IPv6 addresses, and you're just going to use that, deploy it throughout your enterprise, even on end hosts that are inside the company behind a firewall, and then that firewall is going to just govern who can get in and out, and there's just not going to be a NAT process there. That's over time, it sounds like the desire is for that to go away.
Yeah, and I actually think that people that implement their networks this way, they'll find that they prefer it because NAT also, it embeds a certain amount of complexity into your network. If you try to troubleshoot a network that's based on NAT and you have application issues or something, it's much more difficult when you just have direct connectivity from host to host. You know, you can do packet captures and you see the actual addresses trying to do things, and that can be invaluable when things aren't working right. People will learn to like that, I think.
You have to remember that once upon a time, NAT didn't exist. Like, I can remember configuring networks 15 years ago onto the internet, and all hosts were publicly, you know, had public IP addresses that were being exposed to the internet, and there was no port address translation, no network address translation, and it's kind of like it was much straightforward, it was much simpler to install, much easier to maintain. This NAT was a complexity put in because we were running out of addresses. Remember that. NAT wasn't put in to make it secure. It wasn't put in to help firewalls. It was put in to solve the fact that we were running out of IP addresses, IPv4 addresses. That was its point.
Mm-hmm.
There is one other trick. Just coming back to IPv6 addressing, there are solutions to getting IPv6 addresses for your network that don't involve NAT. And one of those is proxy servers. So, for example, you can have HTTP proxy servers on your network edge send, for example, your HTTP traffic to the proxy server on an internal IPv4 address, but the proxy server will make the request on the outside with an IPv6 address. Now, that is not NAT. That is a genuine proxying of the connection, and that could give you IPv6 access to the internet without IPv6 addressing the inside of your network. And that is a transition mechanism that I don't think a lot of people have considered at this time.
Yeah, you've deployed that somewhere, right, Greg?
I have. I've designed it into a network. The only challenge at the moment is that firewalls don't always support IPv6. So as I'm building DMZs now and external firewall gateways, I'm actually saying this is where the IPv6 goes, here, 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 and this DMZ is IPv6 ready and it'll have this. And we actually put all the addresses on, but we haven't actually turned it on because our upstream providers don't support IPv6 and one of our firewalls doesn't support IPv6 in our current software implementation. So those of you who have Blue Coat proxy servers or Squid servers or Barracuda web application file gateways or Ironport proxy servers with content scanning, you can have an IPv6 address on the outside, have two interfaces in the box, IPv6 on the outside, and there's your IPv6 to the internet. And that box goes out IPv6 forward, and internally in your IPv enterprise network, you can then start progressively migrating and continue to use a proxy server. and go forward without all of the challenges, perhaps. And that's just another way of thinking about things if you want.
So let's say I'm an enterprise and I'm you're ready to take the plunge. You know, step number one would be having an IPv6 block allocated to me. I mean, globally, are all the registrars ready to give addresses out? I know Aaron certainly is.
Yeah, all of the regional internet registries, I have been allocating IPv6 addresses for pretty much as long as they've existed, almost. In the case of RIPE, who's been around the longest, they started allocating IPv6 addresses when the RFCs were ratified in the late 90s, and the same thing with ARIN. The other registries, as they've come online, have also been allocating v6 addresses. And at least in the ARIN region, the policies for getting a v6 address are really the same as getting a v4 address. And what I mean by that is, if you qualify to get IPv4 space from ARIN, you qualify to get v6 space as well. And you don't have to have v4 to get v6. You just have to have a show that you need the addresses and that you will be using them. And that's really the only step. You know, the cost of entry and the barrier to entry is actually really low. People don't realize that.
The block size that Aaron is handing out, I believe I went up to the site and it struck me that, wow, they're really handing out a lot more address space. I mean, even the smallest block was rather substantial. Is that, does that sound about right?
Well, it depends on your point of view, I guess. I mean, the address space is so vast in V6 that, you know, I think the smallest block that Aaron gives out is a /48. And that may seem large, but in the big scheme of things, a 48 in V6 is really like a 24 in V4. Mm-hmm. So it's really not that much space. A 48 is the minimum allocation that most ISPs will route on the V6 internet today. And so that's where that comes from.
And what would that cost to set up and then each year after that?
You're talking to the network operations manager, so I don't have the pricing information right in front of me.
I think it's in the hundreds of dollars, though.
Yeah, it is. It's in the hundreds of dollars. It's not a whole lot at all. And I think that from a policy standpoint, you have to show that you have an immediate need to IP 1,000 hosts, 1024 hosts, and that you'll be addressing an additional 2,000 or so hosts over the next year. And if you can prove that you have that need, you can come to Aaron and get a direct allocation from us. And I believe that most of the other registries have very similar policies. You know, when it comes to that kind of addressing policy, there's quite a bit of parity.
Jan, has that been your experience with RIPE as well? I assume you're dealing with RIPE?
RIPE started, I think they started giving out IPv6 addresses a long time ago, but getting provider-independent addresses has been a problem since they only implemented this policy of actually handing out provider-independent addresses, I think, about a year ago. So when we wanted for us and our customers to actually obtain PI addresses, we had to wait until the policy was actually accepted and put in place. And I think they don't have, perhaps they have a bit less strict requirements of how many hosts you intend to have, but we are typically given a /48 for a customer, and this again is a PI space, so you have to demonstrate that you will be multi-homed. If you will not be multi-homed, of course, you just go to your local provider and they will typically hand you out a provider aggregated 48 out of their own address space.
Yeah, I should point out that the numbers as far as hosts that I said have to do if you're single homed. Multi homed, the number of hosts, the host requirement goes way, way, way down.
Okay, sure. Now, in IPv6, I know that there are different classifications of address. There's a link local address. You mentioned a /7. That's the EULA address, and there's other ones. When you guys want to talk about some of these different classifications and how they fit, because that's another thing that when they start getting into IPv6, it kind of throws them. What am I really looking at here?
Yeah, sure. Link local addresses, they were designed by intention to be used kind of for network auto configuration. So, you know, the moment you plug an IPv6 enabled host into a network, into the actual link, it can talk IPv6 using link local addressing. And it can use this to find routers, to find other hosts, to basically bootstrap itself onto the network. And so link local addresses, every host has one if it's V6 enabled. You'll always see two addresses. Well, at least one address. You'll see a link local address, and you'll potentially see a global address, assuming that that is a site that's on the global IPv6 internet. So that's one type of address, and
a link
critical.
Local, is that a routable address or not?
It is not routable,
right?
And I think it is critical to IPv6 functionality because it is responsible for things like neighbor discovery, router advertisements, and router solicitations all happen over the link local.
It sounds like you're describing functions that multicast or some broadcasts would have done in an IPv4 world. Does that sound like a fair comparison?
Yeah, in many ways. You know, in V4 you have ARP, you know, on a local Ethernet segment that will send out broadcasts to do configuration for hosts and stuff like that. Link local addresses, they help fulfill part of that functionality in V6, because really the ARP protocol no longer exists. It's been replaced.
Okay. So aside from link local, which we've talked about, and then we've got global addresses, we've got this EULA kind of classification of addresses. Are there any other special classifications of IPv6 addresses that we should be aware of?
Yeah, sure. There's of course multicast addresses, which are basically very similar to their IPv4 counterparts. Multicast is plays a bigger role in V6 than it does in V4 because there are, as I said before, there's some configuration, you know, automatic address configuration and host discovery and things like that that use multicast in V6 that in V4 they use broadcast traffic for. There's another basically completely new class of addresses as well, and that's anycast addresses. And this isn't anycast in the way that you think of anycast in V4. Unfortunately, the IETF decided to reuse the term anycast in IPv6, and basically what an anycast address is in V6, it's really just like any other V6 address. It's a globally routable V6 address that can be shared amongst hosts, and there's a special header that is placed inside of IPv6 packets potentially that say send it to this address, and if that address is an anycast address, the special headers will effectively direct that packet to the host that is closest to the sender. Even though multiple hosts may share that address on the global network, the header extension should send that packet to the closest host using that address. And it's basically another way of doing anycast from, you know, the network trickery that we're all used to today.
Jan, did you want to comment on any of that, or Greg?
I still struggle with the idea of anycast. I'm not understanding the purpose of IPv6 anycast at this point in time. I understand that it's meant to represent a single destination IP address for services in multiple geographical locations. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, and I'll agree with you, it's hard for me to understand its use case, especially when you can do the anycast that we're all used to, using BGP announcements to anycast V6 addresses or V6 networks in the same way. I actually don't know of any sites that are using V6 anycast, at least not outside of, you know, research and experimentation.
It just seems odd to me. They go on and on about it. It's as if it's supposed to be have some special capabilities or extend some, like you can't configure it on a device, you can only configure it on a router or a load balancer or something.
Yeah, well, you know, I also think that it's one of those things that it will probably find a use eventually. Somebody's going to look at this and say, ah, you know, we can use this to make this work better or to deploy this new type of service. So, you know, I don't think it certainly doesn't hurt anything that it's there, but at the same time, I'm not sure.
Well, I guess there's lots of features of IPv4 that we just never used. There's dozens of standards of IPv4 things that we just never got used by us.
I think that's a really good point. And, you know, V6 is going to be around for a really long time. You know, the address space is such that we are extremely unlikely to face depletion, at least in our lifetimes. And who knows what people will think of in terms of, you know, addressing this. You know, it could be that, you know, the interplanetary internet of the future requires V6 anycast in order to place nodes, you know, halfway between here and Mars or something. Who knows?
Yeah. It's funny, Matt, you were just saying, hey, IPv6 is here to stay. It's going to be with us for a very long time. And I think there's maybe a lot of people that have still got their fingers crossed somehow or another that we're going to pull this IPv4 thing out and it's going to be okay. And someone's going to do something other than IPv6 and they're not going to have to make the leap. But reality is we got to make the leap.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the V4 internet will eventually stop growing. You know, there's a finite number of addresses, and it could be that the V4 internet is around for quite some time. You know, there's not necessarily any good reason for it to go away, but there's going to be a lot of companies that come to Aaron or other registries and need IP addresses to establish their internet presence, and eventually we won't have any addresses to give them. The only addresses we can give them are IPv6 addresses, which means in the coming years you'll have enterprises that come online that only have a V6 presence on the internet, and that will mean that eventually if you're a V4 only host, you're going to have this huge part of the internet that's V6 enabled that you won't be able to see without the aid of proxies or NAT or something like that. And, I mean, everybody knows that by its very nature, any sort of proxy or network address translation has inherent inefficiencies or, you know, performance penalties, whatever, that people aren't going to want that. They're going to want to be natively connected to the network. And I think that we'll see tons of use cases that make that very apparent, especially video on demand and things like that. People are going to want as much performance as they can get. So absolutely.
Just jumping in there on the video on demand, I think that a lot of these video companies, sort of like the television companies and the content providers, are going to demand a fixed IP address so that they can identify as part of their copy protection regime that the end station is not hidden behind some sort of gateway. And I think we're going to see, one of the big things about IPv6 was that the endpoint is talking directly to the other endpoint, and there's no intermediate gateways that can spoof a connection or emulate a connection or interfere with end-to-end connectivity. So the application is talking end-to-end in a dedicated channel. Whereas when we use NAT, there's actually an obfuscation going on, and it causes the security of a lot of software. So inherently, end-to-end connectivity of an IPv6 design is far more secure from an application point of view, and for the Hollywood's getting closer to locking up all their content behind exclusive DRM, you may see their DRM demand an IPv6 address in the future.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, end-to-end connectivity coupled with V6's inherent support for IP security, it will be a boon to those kind of providers that want to ensure that their packets are not being manipulated or possibly decrypted from, you know, the sender to the receiver. And yeah, the set-top box scenario and video on demand is a great example of that. It's one of those killer features for IPv6 that, I think those kind of providers will use, but also, anybody else that demands security for their application.
Well, bank, of course, turn this around the other way and turn it to something that's in our favor, and that's, of course, online banking gets a whole lot more secure because you can actually have a full non-repudiation of the identity of the sender, of the initial requester. So there's equally advantages for us as consumers of, high security services that once IPv6 addresses are ubiquitous, you can... security of those types of things increase, and the current vulnerabilities around SSL and certificates start to get solved.
Oh, yeah. I think that, what we're witnessing in IPv6 as part of this is really the internet is growing up. It's been in its infancy even up to this point. And with the rollout of V6 and some of its built-in security features, along with the rollout of DNSSEC, which is also happening pretty much right now, and the coming rollout of routing security and RPKI and some of these other technologies, all of these vulnerabilities that exist in the network today are slowly but surely being patched up. Our ancestors down the road, the internet is going to be a much more secure place as a result of all the stuff that's going on today, which I think is a really good thing.
Yeah, you guys make a really good point that IPv6 is not just a change in addressing. This is not just a new addressing scheme. This is fundamentally a protocol that's got a lot of thought that was put into it for security and other features from the ground up. So it's not just a change in, geez, dotted quad is now this with hexadecimals and colons. Now it's additionally a new way of thinking about how your network endpoints talk to one another.
Oh, yeah, and I think that it enables so many cool features. As a guy who runs a network, and I have, Aaron has an enterprise network. I have end users that use Windows machines and have laptops and VPN and all that other stuff. One day, I look forward to having, just inherent VPN in my client laptops. It's just built into the OS. It just works. I don't need special clients. I don't need any of that stuff. That will all happen as a result of the IPsec stuff that's built into V6. Mm-hmm. I think that... V6, some of the features that it has were so good that they ended up backported to V4. And I don't think a lot of people realize that, but, IPsec was developed for V6, and it was backported to V4. So was things like quality assurance, quality of service, and things like that. That was all out of the V6 development, and eventually it ended up in V4 because it was just such a good idea.
No, I did not know that. That's about IPsec and QoS. Yeah, that's interesting. Hey, let me take the conversation a little different direction and go towards some of the practical concerns that someone who's actually getting down to the nuts and bolts of deploying IPv6 on their network. Let me address this one towards you. Let's say you're looking at your enterprise network and you've got your allocated block of IPv6 addresses, whether that came from a registry, whether that came from your ISP, and you're looking to deploy it. How do you size subnets? I mean, the very common subnet that we'll see in the IPv4 world is a /24, slightly more than 250 hosts that you can use that keeps the broadcast domain kind of tidy from a layer 2 perspective, and it's a nice, neat boundary to do your subnetting on. It's real easy for most people to follow. Sysadmins make fewer mistakes because of that mask and so on. Is that a realistic boundary where you really get down to something that small? Because IPv6 is just, you know, so big. There's so much address space to play with. How do you do your subnetting?
Yeah, well, the answer is absolutely not. Well, you don't use something like an 8-bit host mask. What you do is it is actually today a standard, a de facto standard, that you have to use 64 bits for the host, and that means that the smallest network, which you will see, is a /64. So you dedicate basically half of your bits in your address space. This is not half of the address space, but half of the bits, way more, to the host part. Why is this so? Because most of the hardware, I believe most of the hardware which we have in today's switches, layer 2 or layer 3 switches, is simply not capable of having TCAM tables or the lookup tables, which would be that big that they would accommodate prefixes which would have sizes up to, let's say, /127 or /120 or something like that. So it's a practical issue today that you basically have to limit yourself and ensure that your end, let's say, leaf networks basically have the maximum prefix of /64. So you're limited to /64. You're typically allocated /48, or if you're a very big company, like a /32. So you're basically left with 16 to 32 bits to play with for the network part. So basically you will typically get a /48. You will have 16 bits to use as the subnet ID, let's say, or a prefix ID, and the last 64 bits you will have to use for the host part. Again, typically because of the hardware limitations we have today.
So does the nature of applications that are running inside of IPv6, do they tend to broadcast less? I mean, one of the concerns is, I mean, you're going to have a much bigger network space that your routers and switches can deal with it. You're not going to fill that up with hosts, though. At the same time, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of network engineers are going to be sitting here going, geez, do I really want to put 1,000 or 2,000 hosts in the same layer 2 space? Wouldn't that be a bad thing? Or does IPv6 just help us take care of that?
No, there are no differences. So the same design practices should apply. So you should still keep, let's say, your leaf nodes or leaf networks with a couple of tens or a couple of hundreds hosts at most. So I wouldn't say there's any big difference here. Applications behave in exactly the same way as far as that is concerned. And you have to also know that there are a couple of addressing schemes which, again, require a lot of bits on the host part. For example, we haven't talked about the EUI 64 address scheme, where the MAC address of the end host is actually encoded in the host part of the IPv6 address, which might cause privacy concerns for somebody. But again, we can kind of assume today that you will always use the last 64 bits for the host part. And again, we assume that you will be clever enough not to cram more hosts than you have in today's networks into that particular leaf network.
Yeah, that's straightforward enough. It's just a different thing than most people are used to thinking about. So now we're going to have a much larger address space that you could potentially put hosts in, but you're just not going to do that as an intelligent design practice. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and can I come back on something you said there? You said that the /64 is what a lot of silicon is optimized for in terms of forwarding performance. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, imagine having, imagine allowing prefixes up to /127. You would basically give people the freedom to basically have a huge number of prefixes, which would really hardly fit into most TCAM tables which you have available today.
So it's not a silicon issue, it's not a variable length mask issue, it's just how many entries you can have in a TCAM.
Yeah, and how to carve the TCAM, because TCAMs are a resource which has to be somehow optimized for the type of entries which you will put in them. And for example,
That's
Cisco
right.
doesn't allow you to have, it would be, for example, for most people it would be really, it makes perfect sense to have a /127, for example, on a point-to-point link, but no, you have to have a /64, because your silicon is typically, will complain if you put a larger prefix on a certain point-to-point link. So you're wasting a lot of address space, but you have to really always keep in mind you have a mind-bogglingly large amount of address space to play with.
Because you've only got a finite number of masks that you can load into a TCAM entry table.
Exactly.
You can have a
yeah.
much larger number of routes or entries, but
yep.
you can only have a finite number of masks. So
the way you organize the TCAM table is really important there for the vendors.
Yeah,
yeah.
Although Cisco does it by mask. Do others do it? And I was of the opinion that some other vendors can organize their TCAM differently, or is that a universal function of TCAM? I'm not sure.
That's a hardware question. I live in a Cisco world, so I know how they carve out the TCAM. So, but I know.
I know that companies like Force 10 Networks and Arista have a lot more TCAM. I think it's Arista, but certainly Force 10 have much larger TCAM tables and may have less of an issue. So it may be worth looking at other vendors if that's a particular. If your network needs that specific feature, then maybe you should be looking around a bit wider than just Cisco's products for that one.
Yeah, but I think it's a global consensus that you shouldn't use more than SSLF64 for the subnet. And I think most of the vendors go with that. And again, it's.
I think it's kind of the same things we had the ABC in the early days of IPv4. It was just a convention. And I wonder if as time goes by, we'll see a change in over time. You know, at the end of the day, we use a /24 today. Why? Because that's a very good number, not because it's based in any sort of logic. So maybe a /64 is the same sort of thing. That's what we start with. And once we're all comfortable with it, we'll move to some other system of allocating, perhaps. It makes sense, though. It's perfectly reasonable to me.
Well, in the mind of the network engineer, you know, another one of the questions that's going to come up is, hey, I know how ARP works. Well, Matt, you pointed out earlier that ARP isn't there anymore, and this is a different discovery process. Let's get down, right down to the mechanics of how that would work. On the assumption we understand how ARP works and that isn't there with IPv6, how do you do a mapping of an IPv6 address to a MAC address so you can push an Ethernet frame across an enterprise network?
Okay, so in IPv6, yeah, ARP no longer exists. All the functionality that ARP provides was replaced by ICMP, or ICMPv6 in this case. And it goes back to the link local addresses and things like that. So when a host comes online, the first thing that it does is it does a router solicitation. It'll send out a multicast ICMP packet basically saying, hey, you know, I'm here. Is anybody else here? And is there a router present? And it should get a router advertisement back. Routers that are configured to send router advertisements, which I believe on Cisco, they are by default. They will send out router advertisements if you have V6 enabled.
So it's basically self-discovery of your gateway for your local segment.
Exactly. And what that router does is say, hey, I'm a router, and this is the network that I'm on. And the host will automatically take that network number and configure it with its MAC address, going back to the EUI 64 addressing, and concoct its own globally routable IPv6 address. And that's how you get an address.
DHCP is what we would be used to. That because of MAC addresses being assumed to be unique everywhere, you can kind of do away with DHCP?
You don't actually need DHCP in IPv6. You know, neighbor discovery, which is another function of ARP, happens in a very similar way on V6. There's an ICMP packet that goes out, and hosts that are on the same network will respond back to the host that sent the packet. It's actually really simple. There's also potentially some security problems that result from that behavior. So ICMP replaces ARP, and that's
so
actually
that
really
is the sending ICMP message says, hey, I'm looking for this destination IPv6 address, and the responder comes back with an ICMP message that has his MAC address embedded in there somewhere so that a frame can get made at that point?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, using ICMP for neighbor discovery also has a couple of hidden problems. For example, all of your router ACLs, which you might use, now have to account for this ICMP. So if you migrate your IPv4 ACLs to IPv6, you suddenly have to actually also include a bunch of ICMP messages in your ACL permitting that ARP-like behavior. So that's one problem. The second issue is it is not really standardized which addresses you use for this ARPing in ICMP and IPv6. So remember, each host has a global address and a local address, and there's kind of a local multicast address to which you actually send the ICMP packet. And in practice, we found out that hosts use all kind of mixtures, like using a source link local address or a global address, and basically your ARP ACL ICMP neighbor discovery ACL in IPv6 gets all messy, and hopefully you don't do and permit ICMP any just because of this. But again, you have to have a little patience with IPv6 and discover what addresses your neighbors are using for neighbor discovery. And just one thing I would like to point out, because ARP is replaced by basically multicast ICMP, or basically rooted ICMP, now all the ARP spoofing attacks extend past your layer 2 boundary, layer 3 boundaries. So basically now an ARP spoofing attack, what was previously called an ARP spoofing attack, could now take place over the internet, and somebody could, let's say, do a denial of service attack by poisoning your network discovery, neighbor discovery caches from, let's say, thousands of miles away. So that's an interesting attack vector in IPv6, where IPv6 is more vulnerable compared to IPv4 because it allows neighbor discovery to attacks to extend past your layer 3 boundaries.
Is DNS any different in the way that it behaves?
Well, not at all. DNS basically behaves in a very similar way. What they're doing in DNS security is a different story, which I think is more or less protocol independent. You can absolutely use DNS v4 for your v6. So, for example, in most of our customers, we are using simply the plain old DNS v4 for IPv6 resolution because DNS, classic DNS over v4, can also carry quad A records, so that there's no problem with that. So for DNS, I think personally, I see DNS as one of the last services I want to migrate to v6 because, again, v4 DNS will do its job perfectly to provide the resolution for v6 addresses. Unless you have a pure v6 network, I think you can use your plain old DNS, perhaps secured with DNSSEC in the future, for all the resolution that you might need.
But just a note there, you will need, going back to the DHCP point and DNS together, you will still need DHCP if you want to dynamically register the workstation's name in the DNS. So even though you don't have to have DHCP to do dynamic address allocation, you can use link local and neighbor discovery. If you want to register a machine name in the DNS like we do with Active Directory today, for dynamic DNS, you'll still need a DHCP server to load that machine name, to discover the machine name, and then load it across to the DDNS function.
Absolutely. And if you want to keep control over your addresses, it's perfectly okay to use DHCP version 6 to basically statically assign specific addresses to specific MAC addresses. So you can still use your old practices with DHCP before and carry them over to DHCP version 6. That's basically the same thing for you.
Importantly, that also means you don't have to know the IP address of an end host. You can just ping the name. And if it replies, you don't have to go and scratch out the IPv6 address and then try and ping that. You can...
Yep.
You know, if it doesn't, if you ping the name and the name doesn't respond, and then you start troubleshooting, then you might look for the absolute IPv6 address to attempt to ping that, or you might ping the router gateway, which you might have stored in a, in another location. But DDNS is the first, is absolutely an important part of IPv6 infrastructure, as far as I'm concerned. DDNS is really vital to working out problems.
Okay, listeners, we're going to stop the podcast there for this week. So that was part one of Enterprise IPv6 and deploying IPv6 in your network. Ascolta Training is a U.S.-based, award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner offering an array of advanced courses delivered using Cisco-authorized course material. You can access that training by attending one of Ascolta's regularly scheduled classes or talk to them about customized private training tailored to meet the specific needs of your business. Ascolta has the right solution for you, so contact them at 1-800-297-4294, on the web at www.ascolta.com, or on Twitter as @Ascolta. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, and you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. Ascolta Training wants you to learn something. Until next week, you can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers, and follow our blog at packetpushers.net. And as always, send us your thoughts and email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Have a great week, all.